Welcome to another edition of Sci-Fi on Screen. I'm your host, Jeff Palermo. And in this week's episode, we're going to be talking about Ridley Scott's seminal science fiction film, 1979's Alien. Lots of background on Alien, obviously. And I'm going to start with the two guys who cooked it up, Dan O'Bannon and Ron Chassette. Dan O'Bannon, first, when he was at USC, he was kind of buddy buddies with John Carpenter, and they made a film called Dark Star. In the film, there was an alien included, which had been created basically using a spray-painted beach ball. The experience left O'Bannon kind of wanting to do something that looked a lot better than a spray-painted beach ball. Ron Chassette, meanwhile, was sort of a screenwriter working on an early version of what eventually would become Total Recall. So he saw Dark Star, very impressed with the film, contacted O'Bannon, and the two basically agreed to collaborate. They decided to work on O'Bannon's film first, as they thought it would be less costly to produce. O'Bannon had written 29 pages of a script titled Memory, which is kind of what would be the film's opening scene. Started with a crew of astronauts awakening to find that their voyage has been interrupted because they're receiving a signal. They investigate and so on and so forth, and he didn't have any idea really who the alien antagonist would be and where the story would go. Then O'Bannon took a gig with Alejandro Jodorowsky, as Jodorowsky was working on his film adaptation of Dune. That entire story, actually, is a really, really interesting documentary called Jodorowsky's Dune, which I highly recommend, actually. It's a really good film. So O'Bannon shuttles off to Paris for 6 months to work on the film. It falls through, but there, he's introduced to H.R. Giger, who Jodorowsky also had signed on to do the Dune project. Kind of a crucial connection there that O'Bannon and Giger met the Dune project. So O'Bannon returns to L.A. Him and Chassette revive the script. They combine some other ideas. I think Chassette came up with the idea about an alien impregnating one of the crew members in order to get it on board the ship. So they crank through almost like 85% of the story. And they started presenting the scripts to some studios, pitching it as Jaws in space. They've ultimately, through most, you know, production hell, obviously, they signed a deal with a company called Brandywine, which is a guy named Walter Hill, who you know is the director of Warriors, most famously, but many other genre films, and a guy named David Giler. So they took the script from O'Bannon and Chassette, and they made a lot of revisions. They added Ash, and that storyline, and worked on the dialogue to make it a little more realistic. At that point, it was ready to go. O'Bannon assumed that he was going to direct Alien, because I guess he had some cred going to USC Film School, but 20th Century Fox asked Walter Hill to direct, and Hill declined, because he had, I guess, other gigs going, and he wasn't too keen on directing something with a lot of effects. Came upon Ridley Scott's The Duelists, which he made in 1977, and basically offered him Alien straight away, which he took. Scott then jumped on and created these detailed storyboards for the film, which impressed 20th Century Fox so much that they like doubled his budget. And then O'Bannon introduced Scott to Giger. They realized that Giger's painting Necronom 4 was basically, you know, the genesis of the alien character. There's a quote the first time from some industry guy, the first second that Ridley saw Giger's work, he knew that the biggest single design problem, maybe the biggest problem in the film, had been solved. So Scott flies to Zurich, meets Giger, and Giger signs on, basically design everything that's connected to the alien. So there are a couple of versions of the film. I chose to do the theatrical version, as I always think that the amount of craft that these guys put in right when they're birthing the movie the first time, I think it's just closest to to me, what's the original vision? Are you listening, George Lucas? There's a director's cut, which adds, I think deletes a few things and adds a few things that are inconsequential, but it does add a scene where Ripley finds Dallas being cocooned on her way out of the ship. And I, you know what? Whatever. I wanted to go back and you know, the original film as it impacted audiences and kind of review it. That's some background. The cast I'll get into as we go. So let's jump in. We open in space. Jerry Goldsmith scored the film, and very sparse use of music in this film, but when it is used, very, very effective. We get Jerry Goldsmith's eerie score, and we see, you know, the word alien slowly begins to appear sort of bar by bar on the screen. The camera pans by a planet, very beautiful, opening credits, and then we cut to what looks like a flying oil refinery, actually, and a title card that reads, Commercial Towing Vehicle, the Nostromo, Crew 7, Cargo Refinery Processing, 20 million tons of mineral ore. course returning to Earth. So now we get a very Star Wars-like opening shot as the Nostromo and the refinery sort of pass by overhead. It's very grimy and very gritty and very real. And then we're inside. The entire opening of this film is so stately and so paced in a languorous way. I think it's wonderful. And it starts right as you go inside. You're panning around an empty ship. So there's a set of claustrophobic hallways, lots of shadows. Then the camera tracks through an empty mess hall with these little dunking ducks that people used to have, where the duck drains some liquid and it pops up and pops back down again, which is sort of the only movement on an empty ship, which I think was really cool. On the bridge, we see some movement, some papers shuffling and fluttering from some kind of breeze. Everything goes very, very quiet, and we focus in on a computer screen, and then all of a sudden, that screen comes to life, and we see a series of commands on the screen, very old-style computer graphics, but it's fine. Some sound effects, and we gather something has happened, and then we start to see the lights coming on in different parts of the ship. Even when they come on, you know, they come on like, in a sense, like old fluorescent lights. One of them kind of flickers on a little bit. Like, we're already starting with the truckers in space, you know, the grimy sci-fi that Ridley, you know, admittedly got straight from Star Wars, which, you know, really George kind of really nailed with the Tatooine and the Rebels sequences of sci-fi, ships being grimy and dirty. You know, they pioneered that completely. And Ridley, definitely rightly so, takes off right from it. And now we slowly pan into the hibernation chamber, and the lights come up, and these seven sort of flower-like tops of the hibernation pods all gently rise at the same time. The crew slowly revives. The revivation process, I don't even know if that's a word, but I spelt it that way. The reviving process is done as this montage, so you see one character move a little bit, and then, you know, another frame sort of cuts into that frame, and that frame kind of dissolves slowly. So there's this wonderful montage of the crew reviving. And, it, you know, Ridley's in just the top of his game here. Everything is shot so beautifully, and this anamorphic widescreen that he uses, he's such a master at it. In short order, now we're in the mess hall, and all the crew is revived. From here until the alien is actually on board ship, they set up this movie so well that I think the setup does so much work on making the rest of the film as chilling and terrifying as it is. They're all sitting around a table having breakfast, right? And they're smoking, first of all. So I don't think I've ever seen smoking in science fiction before. I haven't seen Dark Star, so I don't know about that. But there's this wonderful lighting, this down lighting on them. There's tons of crosstalk. So it's not right now, you know, as you're panning around them, you're not getting any dedicated dialogue on the screen. It's just characters chit-chattering amongst themselves. And Ridley's camera moves around the table. To me, in a sense, we've also broken the kind of fourth wall and that the camera now can go anywhere. When we get to Kane, played by John Hurt, he looks terrible and he's just sitting there and he looks at another character and he says, "I'm dead." And I always think that that's an interesting foreshadowing. He will be the first to go. And then they're getting into this talk about bonuses and shares. I mean, it's like a union meeting, you know? I work in an industry where I deal with guys in unions a lot. And I mean, this couldn't be more real. Parker, played by Yaphet Kotto, and Brett, played by Harry Dean Stanton, are the two kind of mechanics on the ship, right? And they're getting less money. They get, I believe, half shares. And all the frontline officers on the ship, on the Nostromo, get full shares. And they're bitching about it. And it's just classic. And they're just like, there's no wonder of being in space. There's no awe and wonder of the galaxy here. These are like, they don't give a shit about space or about exploration or about, you know, the things that science fiction itself is, you know, has been concerned with up till now. They're like, they're bitching about their shares, and it's done so well. I mean, the casting in this film is masterful, frankly. It's wonderful, and they're talking about all this stuff, and then Tom Skerritt, who plays Dallas, the captain, he goes to talk to Mother, and the computer, if I hadn't said it before, they call the main computer, the AI on the ship, Mother. Dallas heads off to go speak to Mother. The crew is now broken up to go to their duty stations. We get Veronica Cartwright and Sigourney Weaver in the bridge area. You know, we just hear like, where are we? This is not our system. And they're starting to realize that they're not home. You know, where's Earth? Again, all the talk and the chatter as they come to this conclusion is just, it's so realistic, you know. It's so just off the cuff, and no one's saying anything portentous, and there's no Hollywood lines, you know. I know Aliens is celebrated as this amazing film, and it is a great film, and I will definitely cover it very soon, as I'm going to do all the Alien films. But, you know, even Cameron's military jargon, which he nails, it's very Hollywood and very stagey, you know, and it's awesome in its own right, and I'm not criticizing it. But compared to the way the opening dialogue is on Alien, Alien is almost like a fucking documentary, and how realistic. I mean, you are so rooted in this crew because of the throwaway lines and the workmanlike functions of everyone. And there's no characters, you know, you don't get, like, even in Aliens, right, you get Hicks and you get Vasquez, and you immediately get characterizations of characters. Here you don't really know anyone yet. No one's really jumping out at you. They're all just like, I don't know. I don't know how they got away with doing it, but it's genius because it almost feels like a docudrama at this point. I'm going to probably overtalk that for the next third of the movie, but it's amazing. So they reconvene back in the mess hall after Dallas has gone in to talk to Mother. What's happened, obviously, as we all know, as fans of this film, right? They intercept this transmission of unknown origin, but rather than getting into the possibility of extraterrestrial life, right, no one gives a shit about it. It's just talk about, like, we're not going to get home to Earth right away. And Parker and Brett right away are like, do we get full shares? And they're bitching and moaning about the money. And Ash has to step in because Parker's kind of refusing to do it. And he reminds him that there's a clause in their contract that states, you know, that if any signal is received that may hint at life, that priority one is to go investigate. And the kicker here for Parker is that if they choose not to do it and the company finds out, the Weyland-Yutani Corporation, by the way, which is the main company in Alien and Prometheus, that they forfeit all their shares. So they would have, you know, I guess gone on the trip for nothing and not gotten paid. So again, it's all about the money. And they rightly focus on that. You know, like, truckers in space wouldn't all of a sudden drop their guys and say, oh my God, a life, what would I be? You know, they wouldn't go into, like, geek mode. These are workers who barely make enough probably to live from some company who, you know, grinds them down for every dime they can, you know. Shocking. Not so far removed from today. Again, all of it is part and parcel why the opening of Alien is so amazing. So now we get some technical action as they, you know, they go into orbit. They get into this drop ship and we see this planetary system ahead. Beautifully shot. A series of planets, one with rings. And again, lots of technical talk about what they're about to do. And it sounds like NASA stuff. You know, some of the way they talk about how they're dropping and as they're monitoring their descent, it's so technical that we as a casual user have no idea what they're talking about. And it sounds very much like NASA speak. You know, lots of digital insertion graphics, which are right out of 2001, showing their place in terms, you know, of the planet and their sort of orbital trajectory. And very cool. And the dropship, all models, so looks amazing. I don't think it's actually a dropship, actually. I think it's the Nostromo itself. It just detaches from the refinery to go investigate the signal. So it's the Nostromo itself, and it's just this bulky, dirty, blocky thing. And it's a wonderful model, and it looks fantastic. The exterior shots are not dated because they use models. There's no CGI to date. Everything's done very slowly, so it all has this kind of majesty to it, more along the lines of 2001 than Star Wars, you know. But Ridley's classical style of directing just keeps this movie incredibly vital. Other than some of the computer interface effects, I mean, this movie dates so little from 1979 to today. To me, it's a lesson in directing that the more you go back to basics and just make the image look as best you can and frame the film in classical style, the less you're going to date. The more whiz-bang you try to go, I think, as a director. You know, we'll see how Pulp Fiction dates, or how it's dating. I haven't seen it in a while. Or other more visually striking directors. You know, we'll see how their films date. But what a lesson in directing from Ridley for at least 2000, at least Blade Runner and Alien. Visually do not date, and they're as beautiful and top of the chain today as they were back then. So there's a wonderful, wonderful descent of the ship. It's huge, the Nostromo, full of grandeur. When they land, one of the claws is damaged, and all of a sudden, the ship starts to, there's some explosions on the ship and some shorting out and smoke and there's alarm sounding and the two mechanics give this repair window. And it's funny because Parker asks Brett, you know, how long will it take to repair? Brett says about 18 hours. And when Parker gets on the comm, he tells him 25. So, you know, that's their gig now. They're going to be busy fixing the ship. And now that they're down, there's been no response to the transmission. It seems to be an automated signal. But again, the whole thing is just so subdued and matter of fact. What I call like this grave realism. You know, up until now, I've talked about the realism of this film, but there's something even more interesting in that the dialogue itself, there is definitely such a thing as cinematically realistic dialogue where characters are talking and it's meant to convey not any information, just the sense of characters are talking. But even in the opening shots of Alien and Descent, there's something off about the dialogue in a real way. Like, it's almost as if all of it was improvised, because some of it is the way they kind of mutter certain lines and the way they pause between certain sentences. If you really watch this opening 20 minutes of the film, it's astonishing how matter-of-fact and documentary-like the dialogue is. Everything just seems so incredibly naturalistic. And for me, it grounds the movie in these like iron, rock-solid realism that, you know, everything else that will come on top of it will be sitting on top of this incredibly gritty and real crew and the atmosphere. And even the hell with, you know, new life. They're arguing about shares and money. Like, it's so true to life and so relatable. They've taken an incredibly high concept thing and they've made it instantly relatable to anybody with a job, frankly. You know, the way that it's pulled across, that these are more technicians. They're not astronauts. It's not sexy. The way the dialogue comes across, how they're saying things, we don't understand half of the technical jargon that they're speaking, and that's the beauty of it. It's like, these are just, you know, your basic, a bunch of truckers in space doing their job. But it's brought about in such subtle, amazing ways, and it's so uncinematic in its, you know, in its individual moments, but together, put the whole thing together, and you're grounded in this, you know, I feel like I'm on the International Space Station, you know, it's incredible, so... And so understandable why it's so rare and unduplicated, because it would take, you know, to get this kind of a thing by, you know, savvy, media savvy suits now. I can't imagine it. Like, if the Alien script went through the mill today, this whole opening would change. Character would have to be revealed. Everything would be punchy. There would be, you know, more jokes. There'd be, you know, every line would have to matter. Like, it would all have to conform to like screenwriting 101, right? But not much is revealed except Parker and Brett are bitching about their shares. And we don't know much about the rest of the crew, you know, and now we're off on the mission. So, but I think because of that is why Alien so begins so grounded. So I'll try not to keep repeating myself. So now we're getting ready to go EVA, as they say. Ash, played by Ian Holm, you know, does this weird kind of warm-up, and we get these wonderful exosuits with these large helmets. They're very cinematic, really amazing design, and we hear this incredible moaning winds of outside, and they've done atmospheric analysis, and, you know, it's just not breathable, so they have to be fully suited, and there's all kinds of dust blowing outside, and we get the size of the Nostromo as the three astronauts sort of emerge from the elevator that dropped them down to the surface. Is massive. And we also are setting up now for a variety of camera shots where you're getting shots on the Nostromo from Ash's point of view and Ripley's point of view as they're looking at the helmet cameras of the expeditionists, for want of a better word, as they're walking towards things. So you get this grainy helmet cam scene, and then you're getting Ridley's beautiful shots of the crew as they're sort of clambering around the rocks and moving through the thing. So, you know, it keeps you different types of shots. It keeps it interesting. I think Ridley was a little ahead of his time with that idea because they do that more often now than ever. And you get, you know, Ridley's stately widescreen with a little jittery Steadicam and then some kind of found footage, you know, and they keep cutting back between the three. And it keeps you interested as a viewer. Dallas, Kane, and Lambert are the three out exploration. Then we get a little bit of a subplot going on as Ripley asks Ash about the transmission. Has anyone decoded it yet? And she starts to take a look at it. And it's our first kind of glimpse and impressions of Ripley. Sigourney Weaver is wonderful in this. She definitely has a screen presence, and there's something about her that works. She's surrounded by this incredible cast, and you know, I think it's a testament to her that she doesn't pale. I mean, you know, she's up against some heavyweight actors, John Hurt and Skerritt and Ian Holm and Yaphet Kotto and Harry Dean Stanton. I mean, you know, these are heavyweight players, man. And she comes across okay, kind of this very by-the-book warrant officer who, you know, seems to have a very rigidness about her, but, you know, will come to really, really flower as the crisis gets going, you know. So it's a good start. So now Ridley's following the three explorers as they're going in through these rocky caves, and you know, there's just the way he shoots it, you know, sometimes the helmets look like they're partially fogged up, but they just look beautiful. And we hear their breathing sounds, and we get this low moon shining over everything. It's just this really eerie alien, you know, landscape. It's wonderful. And then all of a sudden, they get a gander of the crashed ship in the distance. What's great is first you see it via Ridley's stately widescreen shot, you know, and it's basically a matte painting, so it is what it is, this beautiful kind of horseshoe shape. To me, what makes it more real is we cut back to the Nostromo, and now you're looking at it the way Ash is looking at it through Dallas's helmet cam, and so now you're getting a look at it through like a fuzzy found footage type of camera. And to me, once I saw it through that, it was real. And, you know, very similar to how Lucas did with the holography technology where, you know, Princess Leia is not perfectly pristine and perfect. Like, it's all fuzzy. It's, you know, the minute that happened, I was like, this is real. And I'm in, you know. And there's this wonderful mist rising near the ship. And then as they get closer, we see three small figures in their helmet lights and the backdrop of the ship. So we get the scale of how massive the ship is. And then they enter into that, you know, this legendary set of the space jockey. On their way in, we get these wet ribbed tunnels covered by moisture. They look like you're inside of a rib cage, and we're in Giger territory now. We're getting all kinds of lens flare and more of what I call a non-dialogue dialogue. It's just so off kilter and off beat, and none of it's perfect. It's all just, you know, like it's a documentary of three astronauts fixing the space station. And it continues here on the exploration. So when you see the camera kind of pulls up and out to get the whole space jockey set, the three figures standing there are actually three children that were used with smaller spacesuits to make the set itself look even more grandiose. And my God, what can you say about such a seminal scene of just the sense of awe and mystery about it all? And why Alien, I think, is such a great movie, even on its own, even now, is that nothing was solved. You don't know anything about where the alien came from, what the jockey was doing there. And I think all this Prometheus crap that they're doing now to sort of highlight all the mysteries about all the stuff that happens will only ruin the experience of seeing Alien. Because once all this stuff becomes known, once, you know, I'm sure the Prometheus sequel, they're going to find the engineer homeworld, and you're going to find out the whole story about what happened with the engineers, and how did the space jockey get there. And the next time you go to see Alien, you're just going to be like, oh yeah, I know all about the space jockey. And it's going to ruin what's so important about speculative fiction is that you do not pay off on everything. You pay off on the main through line, but you have to leave stuff in there. I mean, as much as I couldn't even stand Lost after the first season, I loved the first season, right? But I know that there's that scene of the giant foot, right? At some point in Lost, there was a scene of this lower half of a broken statue. And from what I can read, they never solved it, right? And I think that is genius. And having that in a film, especially a science fiction film, having elements that do not get solved or revealed makes the film, because you come out with your head spinning around. Yes, you've gotten the main through line. You've seen the horror slash film of it, right? But there are all these other questions and I think that makes a film, you know, a film can approach a mythology when you treat it that way. You know, when you start paying off and solving all of the problems and all of the questions, there's nothing left, you know, nothing left to think about. And, you know, as human beings, I think we love the unknown. We love the questions. We love to think about what might be. I don't know that getting the answers is that satisfying. It is in the moment, but I think at the end of the day, what's more compelling as a viewer or as a reader or any kind of consumer of culture is the questions it leaves you after. And again, I think since the space jockey's never paid off, it's brilliant. And, you know, they go up and look at it, and Dallas gets up really close and notices that the chest bones have bent outwards, which is a great detail. And in that moment, Kane discovers the egg chamber. And then as they're kind of about to join Kane, you know, they're kind of pulling out of screen. And the camera focuses more and more in on the space jockey. And on one of the space jockey's eyes is like, what do you know? What have you seen? The mystery of it all. And then you're out. You know, now you're in the egg chamber. And it's quite spectacular. So then we cut back to the Nostromo. Ripley is now monitoring Mother's efforts to decipher the message. And we get this cryptic where Ripley thinks that it's kind of a warning. Mother's deciphered half of it, and it's a bit of a warning. And she's telling Ash, like, maybe we should go out after them. And Ash very coldly says, well, at this point, you know, they're there. So they'll kind of know if it's a warning or not, right? And Ripley kind of gets the message in a way. And you know, Ash, what a creepy character. So now they lower Kane down into this chamber, and it's this massive, massive Giger-designed cave with these. It's almost like a giant inside of a rib cage. Again, you know, all the sides with the bones and the everything slick. It's immense. I mean, and we can see it because as Kane's dropping down, you know, the camera pulls back, and Kane's like a speck inside this huge chamber. It's unbelievable. And when he drops down, there's this really cool kind of laser effect. There's like a blue mist, and it's almost as if the mist has a boundary that ends at the laser. And Kane finally breaks the level. He kind of slips and kind of falls right into where all the eggs are. We see all these, this hatchery, as it were, all these leathery eggs. Very creepy. And as he gets close to one, it turns partially translucent, and we see something moving around in there. And it's, oh man, it's creepy. That scene when the egg goes partially translucent is so creepy. To this day, and he's like, what is that? What's in there? And then, of course, the top of the egg opens very slowly. And what I love is as Kane edges closer, the camera really stays on the egg, and there's some gross internal organ-like flesh. It looks like a big fat liver painted red, you know, sitting on the top of it. It's pulsating. It's so gross. And then a couple of quick cuts, and all we kind of see is some spider-legged creature attached to Kane's helmet, and we cut away. What I love here, too, is that you don't know anything about what's happened until a sequence later. Because now we cut back to the Nostromo, and it's the point of view of Ash and Ripley. And as Dallas Lambert return, they're carrying Kane. And we hear very offhand, Dallas is like, oh, there's something attached to his face. We've got to get him to the infirmary. And we get an immediate drama as Ripley is not going to break quarantine. She's telling them that, you know, 24 hours quarantine, you know, there are quarantine procedures. And we realize what kind of Captain Dallas is like, and we kind of, you know, they're not these righteous astronauts, right? They're like, fuck quarantine, man. This is my boy. He's been hurt. I got to get him into the infirmary. And they don't give a shit about quarantine. And Ripley is adamant. She's like, I understand, but I can't let you in. And then we see Ash down by the airlock actually breaks the quarantine manually, lets them in. And then wonderful editing, the next shot, you're right on Kane's helmet and from the side, and you're seeing how it was just melted. It's a beautiful shot. The helmet looks incredibly realistic and heavy and substantial. And the fact that you're seeing this like 5 inches of melted glass, you know, the whole of it, quite amazing. And it's a wonderful reveal of the facehugger because they're cutting the helmet in half, and then the two halves break away, and then boom, we see this facehugger. And it's an amazing animatronic puppet thing that they're doing because it looks as real as it did in 1979. I mean, this thing looks alive. It does not look fake. It does not look put together by special effects props. It looks like they just found this thing. It's incredible. And then they wound up putting him in like a body scanner, and we could see on kind of a blurry scanning screen that there's something down his throat, and Ash suggests that it's feeding him oxygen, keeping him alive, obviously, because he can't, you know, how else would he breathe? Dallas right away is like, I don't give a shit. If it's feeding him oxygen, you know, we got to get it off him. Ash isn't so keen on it. What makes it even more realistic is Ash and Dallas are sort of around the helmet looking at the facehugger, trying to figure out how they're going to get it off him. You know, when you get a shot of Dallas, you get part of the facehugger and the helmet in the shot. It's not stagey, like close up on Dallas looking at Kane, but you don't see Kane or the facehugger. You see the facehugger in all the shots. It's like, I think subconsciously what happens is you're like, well, of course, you can't avoid having that in the shot because it's really there. It's these subtle things that I think this whole podcast strategy of mine is all about how film works on us, not just consciously, but unconsciously. And I think shots like this are exactly how film works, that everything is so much more real when it's shot in certain ways. And, you know, as the camera's moving around looking at this face hugger, I don't get the sense that the shots are staged. I think the camera's just there, and it's almost as if it's a documentary, you know. So just amazing. So now we get, of course, the blood acid moment. They try to pull it off, and we see the constriction of the tail around Kane's neck. And they do this wonderful, they try to cut one digit off. And I love that they follow it down like three decks. It's so cool. And the last scene, which really, I think is an important scene, it cements it in as Dallas puts a pen in the last hole and then pulls it out. We see it smoking and gives it back to Brett. And now we get back in the infirmary, we get this creepy scene of Ash looking at scans of the tissue. Ripley comes in and kind of confronts him, and he's so uncomfortable talking to one-on-one to people, it seems. Like, he's just so uncomfortable about it. And he shuts off the scanner, and he's sort of like, can I help you? What do you want? And Ripley's asking him what he's found, and he's so reluctant to share his findings. Again, we get this wonderful bit of technical talk from Ash, and we only understand half of it, and Ripley has to tell him, what does that mean, you know, in layman's terms? And he's like, what it means is, it's a tough little son of a bitch. We also do understand part of the technical talk. It's just genius. It's just genius. I don't know. I can't even, some of this stuff, you know, how it works on us as viewers, I can't even describe it almost. They, you know, they have the discussion about him hitting the airlock override button, and that he's a science officer and he should know the quarantine protocols more than anyone. And he kind of defends his actions by saying, I was actually obeying a direct order from Dallas. It kind of gets out of it, kind of wiggles out, doesn't really take a stand too much. And then a couple of shots later, we hear from Ash. They're in the mess hall, you know, bullshitting. We find out that Kane is now lying in the infirmary and the facehugger is gone. So now we get our first true horror scene. The lights are off in the infirmary. I believe it's Dallas and Ripley and Ash walking around looking for the facehugger. And we know what the facehugger does and how it moves, and it's a terrifying sequence. Even though I've seen this film countless times, I'm still at the edge of my seat during the sequence. And there's a false scare when Ripley knocks over something. And then it's a terrific scare as, you know, Ripley's looking at Kane, and we as a viewer behind her see the tail start to unfold, and the thing lands right on her shoulder, and she flips out and throws it away. But already you can tell from this scene that Ridley understands horror, and he knows how to do horror. Actually, you know, if he did more horror films, I don't know about now, but because he understands the thing with horror, and that you need to have a stately paced film in order to do horror. You know, you cannot have a crackerjack action movie, which is why I don't think Cameron was a very good horror director, and why the horror setup in Terminator doesn't really work, because Cameron doesn't give it any time. But Ridley knows all too well the tension and suspense needed for a true scare. You have to build, and you have to build it honestly, and you need time and space and a lot of silence to do it. And he does it here, as well as other sequences in the film. And then there's this great moment where Ash walks up to it and he pokes it with one of these sort of little charged pokers they've been using to flush the thing out. And the legs kind of flip together, but it's a reflex action. But even so, you know, you're still on edge as a viewer and it freaks you out. And then they put it on this petri dish. You get real close into the guts of it, and Ash is moving around with a little, you know, scanning tool, and it's disgusting. It looks like the inside of a clam, you know. It's just, oh, it's so gross. So there's a little bit of a gross out in the midst of this horror film, you know. So then we cut to some undisclosed part of the ship, and there's a conversation between Dallas and Ripley. And Ripley's saying, you know, what do you know about Ash? And Dallas said, look, I've had a science officer on board the ship the last six missions, but he was replaced 2 days before this mission with Ash. That's all I know. And, you know, they talk about trust, and Dallas tells her, look, Ripley, I don't trust anybody. And Dallas, you know, really sets up Dallas really as the dilettante captain. He's no hero. He's just like, he's some hangdog schmuck who works for the company. He's just trying to do the best he can, get his crew home, follow orders. There's no big heroic impulses in him. He's not going to make any big bold moves and make any big moral decisions. And I think that's correct. Like, I think because that sets up a vacuum for Ripley to step into when decisions have to be made. He winds up getting killed. You know, it's a place for her to someone finally steps up and leads this little team, which she does in, you know, very dramatic fashion. They finally lift off and they return to the refinery. And now we're into, you know, we're going to start into our second third of the film. And we start out by Kane waking up. You know, then we're all in the infirmary for a last meal before they bed down into hypersleep. And, you know, the chestburster scene. which is an amazing scene. A lot of it, I think, due to the frenzy and the conviction of John Hurt as he flails around on the table. I mean, some of the sounds and noises that he makes are really very extreme. And they really have, you really feel like they have to hold this guy down. And then there's that moment where there's this flash of blood on his chest and everyone stops for a minute and there's this moment of silence. And it gives, that beat of silence gives the chest burster like the dramatic space it needs, because when it comes due, and what's great about when it comes out is it really gives it a full like 5 or 6 seconds where it's just, you're close up on the thing and it looks around and everyone is just so stunned and no one does anything. But it's, oh God, it's so creepy looking and definitely prototypical in terms of what the alien will become. You know, it makes sense visually. Before anyone can even breathe, the thing's tearing off and gone loose in the ship. Now we're really getting into the meat of the movie. I was reading a little bit of the background and you hear Veronica Cartwright react in this scene really intensely, like, oh my God, like there's a real, real visceral reaction. And what Ridley and the production team didn't tell the actors was they knew the chestburster was coming, but they didn't realize the amount of blood that was going to be spurted. And Veronica Cartwright basically gets sprayed with blood. And between that and the scene, they elicited this incredible reaction from her. And it's great because it works. You really, there's something about her reaction especially that's really incredible and really puts you there. The story is crackerjack. We're immediately into the next piece of it. We got to find this thing. Brett makes these sort of cattle prods. Ash designs a motion sensor. They split up into two teams and start to search. You know, immediately we get the stage set that some of the decks are damaged and the lights are out due to some of the damaged systems that they didn't repair, which, you know, part of the plot, right, is they got damaged when they went down there. And now this is part of that. It's a great connective tissue, I think. So now you have Parker, Brett, and Ripley is one team. And so we follow them pretty much. And lots of tension, lots of time, lots of space. We get the first false scare, Jonesy the cat, and they all freak out. But then, of course, you know, we have this, there are a couple of classic horror movie, either, I don't know whether you want to call them cliches or part of what horror movies are, but that they tell, you know, they're in teams, right? And then Ridley's like, Brett, go get the cat. Okay, well, hello, first victim, right? And then there's a very long chunk of time where we follow Brett as he is following for the cat. He goes into this part of the ship that's like, it looks like it's like an old machine shop. It's amazing. And then we see him following Jonesy, and then he sees some skin on the floor, and he picks it up, and it looks like a skin that's been shed. And so we're getting sort of a little bit of a telltale that this alien is already changing. So he goes deeper into the bowels of the ship, and then we get this wonderful set where, you know, he enters into this workspace, and above it is like this white light is shining, and rain is coming down. It's very weird because, you know, it's, to have a spaceship with this high-ceilinged set, and there's all this moisture, and there's chains moving, and there's light coming from another section above it, throwing these moving shadows on the floor, which are really creepy. We have this one moment where we're biting our nails because Brett takes off his cap and he kind of puts his face right into the light and into the rain to kind of rain on him a little bit. And of course, nothing happens. And he finally corners Jonesy, but then Jonesy sees something behind him and Brett turns around and we see the alien is huge. And we see the first evidence of its jaws within jaws as it, you know, reaches out and basically grabs Brett, crunches his face, and then takes him up and away. And immediately now we're into this, you know, final version of the alien, which is very man-sized. And it seems as if now the rest of the teams understand what has happened because I guess Parker was looking for Brett to see what he was taking so long. This was off-screen because we hear Parker describing it. The thing's huge. It's the size of a man. You know, like, so they already know that how big it is. And the fact that, you know, Brett is gone and there's the question of could Brett be alive? So now they regroup, and the new plan is to flush it out of the air shafts because that's how it's moving, flush it into the airlock. Parker rigs up some flamethrowers. Dallas goes in to talk to Mother about how to dispose of this thing, and Mother's no help. It keeps coming back to him that it doesn't have enough data. So he volunteers to be the point person. They're going to lock down all the parts of the air shaft, and he's going to go in by himself. And my God, could you not have a better setup? And there's now a new motion tracker that shows where Dallas is and where anything else is that's moving nearby, which is, my God, what a perfect, you know, vehicle for suspense. we see Dallas in there, and all of a sudden it's moving towards him, and then it vanishes. And then we hear from the rest of the crew that it should be right there, should be right on you, because they're only picking up one signal. And Dallas moves down into a lower part of the air shaft, and he finds some goo, which, you know, we will know what that means. And then all of a sudden the tension ratchets up, and Lambert tells him there's a second signal. And we see it. We see it on the screen making a beeline towards him, and he's in the dark. And then we get this brief shot of the alien as it pops up, and then, you know, we hear Dallas screaming, and then nothing, and we have to assume that Dallas is dead. Parker goes to investigate, and the next shot, we basically see he throws Dallas's flamethrower on the table, and we get a sense that, I have found this, but nothing else. His body, there was blood, but his body was gone. And we hear something about a shuttle. I don't know exactly what that was, and I think it was about, you know, why don't we just get in the shuttle and get out of here, but I think there's too many of them to fit in the shuttle. But so now Ripley steps up, and now we see the flowering of Ripley's character as she steps in and immediately is like, she doesn't panic, everyone else is flipping out, she's not panicking, she's like, we stick to the plan, we flush this thing out to the airlock, we do what we're supposed to do. But now the plot escalation is that Ripley, now being in command, has access to Mother. And she goes in and she finds, which is the twist in this film, this Special Order 937. And we see it printed out on the screen. Thus, Nostromo rerouted, priority one, ensure return of organism for analysis. All other considerations secondary, crew expendable. And as Ridley leans back after taking that in, Ash is there. It's a very chilling moment. Ridley's crying. She's like, this is crazy, you know, what the hell? And she kind of punches Ash, and Ash, she doesn't think Ash is trying to control her at this moment or trying to hurt her, but she just kind of opens up on him and beats his head against the wall because she's just really, really angry, and now leaves the airlock. And then she gets into this place where, you know, Ash begins to close all of the airlocks and trapping her. And then we see a close-up of Ash, and this milky substance is dripping from the top of his head. And so he throws Ripley around, and she's kind of half passed out, half conscious. And then there's this incredibly, it's so weird. I always found the sequence so weird, where he's a machine and he's looking at this human being in front of him and saying, well, how best to kill? And he quite weirdly looks around and sees a magazine and rolls it up and stuffs it in her mouth, trying to jam it down her throat and suffocate her. But in that moment where she's kind of half groggy and not doing anything, the creepy part is that the time given to him just looking around, like, how should I kill this organism? How do I put this thing down? And she is in trouble, but Parker and Lambert show up and they attack Ash. But Ash is really strong. But eventually there's that great sequence where Parker knocks the head off, and we see gross scene of the spewing of all this milky fluid and all these weird bubbles and plastic nodules that come out of the neck. It's so gross. I think O'Bannon and Shusett thought that the Ash subplot was a little too much, but I disagree, and I think it makes this movie so bugfuck and great in that moment of, like, not only are they suffering from the antagonist of the alien, but the company, the very company that they're with, is against them too. And in a sense, Ash would be well rewarded for killing them all and just putting the organism in deep freeze. The only thing here, the only twist here, is that I would think that from the get-go, because when Kane comes back on the ship, you get this moment where Parker's like, why don't we freeze him? And in that moment, I would think Ash, acting on the orders that he knows very well, would agree and say, Dallas, you know, we should freeze this guy and let them deal with it on Earth. And then the alien gets back to Earth. You know, you never really know, is it Ash's curiosity as an organism, right? Does he have a sense of what this thing is? And once he sees what it's doing to Kane, he understands that, you know, freezing it may actually interrupt its life cycle. It should be left to propagate all the way on itself, on its own. I don't know. It's I don't know whether it's a flaw in the film or like a good part of the mystery as you leave the film yet, why Ash lets this thing propagate and doesn't, because Dallas would have done whatever Ash wanted him to do, and why John Hurt wasn't frozen. But anyway, there we are. We think it's dead when his head comes off, but then it tries to kill Parker, and it's on Parker trying to kill him, and its head flapping over backwards. Oh, it's so creepy. And then a great scene is they plug Ash's head in. And so basically it's Ian Holm's head, you know, basically sitting on top of a table. And it's so another creepy moment, really cool. They realize that Ash has been protecting the thing from the start. And there's this great vocal effect now on Ash because he's been damaged. You know, we get this wonderful monologue from Ian Holm about you can't kill it. It's perfect. It's a perfect organism. It's a survivor, so on and so forth. And we get the sense that, you know, Ash is kind of admiring it. It admires its purity, not clouded by morality. Really chilling sequence. Finally, they torch that whole area and they kill, you know, they melt Ash down. And we see this great creepy sequence of the skin melting, the fake skin melting off of Ash and the head beneath. And then Ripley makes a judgment call. We're going to blow up the ship. And that, you know, again, Parker's got to, and Lambert have to go down to this area for atmospheric coolant for the ship. So Ripley decides to set the self-destruct, then realizes that Jonesy is stuck, so she has to go back for Jonesy on her own. Lots of tension here, lots of suspense, and we can hear Parker and Lambert on the comm system. And of course, you know, Parker and Lambert down there, the alien takes them. We see the shadow of it behind her, and mostly we're hearing it through the comm system from Ripley's point of view. They're both screaming, and we know that they're both dead. And we get this, then we get a full-on look at the second set of jaws. It's just the amount of moisture that's like rushing over these teeth as they're opening up for the second teeth to come out and kill. But it kills Lambert in a really creepy and kind of sexist way. It jams its tail up her private parts. It kind of impales her in that way. And I don't know. And I see scenes like that. I don't know how to act. Is that a sadism by the part of the film crew or the production crew, or they just decided to do that? But it's very fucked up, actually. At this point, the alien does not take the bodies. Ripley discovers both of them and then runs for the bridge and finally sets the auto-destruct. And again, we have this great, you know, like a James Bond movie, the cool auto-destruct design. And she has to screw these things in and pull up and press buttons, and it all looks very realistic, which is great. You know, then we get this little dramatic moment of it's 10 minutes to detonation, but there's a 5-minute cutoff. So anytime before 5 minutes, she can deactivate the sequence and not blow the thing up. But anytime after 5 minutes, it's locked on and they're screwed. Ripley has Jonesy, runs back towards the shuttle, and then kind of stops and realizes that the alien is sort of in the way, and she has to detour. I think in that moment, she's left Jonesy by the shuttle. The alien is fascinated with Jonesy and it's knocking it around. So she now has to run back. She wants to, you know, shut off the self-destruct because she realizes she might not be able to get to the shuttle before then. But she's just too late. And Ripley's great here. She's just in such distress and she's crying and angry. She's like, Mother, and fuck you. And she smashes one of Mother's terminals. And then she slowly makes her way back to the shuttle. The creature's gone. She grabs Jonesy, gets in the shuttle. And now we have this tension where it's 1 minute to destruct. Ripley blasts off, and it's kind of a nail biter. You know, you don't think she's going to get far enough away. And the editing here is really terrific. And then we get the big explosion, and then we get our first false ending. And something about the music cue right there where she's preparing to go into hypersleep, and we know something's up. And she puts Jonesy in one of the pods. She does her strip down for the long nap. I always think, you know, horror films have a way of stripping women down to their underwear, and I never know whether it's just, you know, horny directors, or do they do that in order to, you know, make the female character more vulnerable, that there's really nothing in between her and this horrible creature. There's no clothes, no nothing. Jury's still out with me on that one. And then we get this great sort of, you know, hide in plain sight moment where Ridley's, you know, putting something together or do, you know, pressing some buttons to prep. And we see the light kind of flare and we realize that the alien is in the shuttle and it sort of tucked itself in to some piping. And it's kind of half asleep. I guess it was prepping itself for hibernation, knowing somehow that this was the safest place on the ship. And so the arm pops out and Ripley freaks, but she keeps her, you know, keeps her sound under control. And now we get this whole silent last ending. You know, she hides in a locker. The alien hasn't gotten out of its perch. It's still there, kind of preparing for its hibernation. It's not moving. So Ripley realizes she's in the spacesuit locker. Quietly, she climbs into the suit, puts the helmet down, and she leaves the locker, gets ready to blow the airlock. The alien is still in the piping. And then finally, she starts to push this button. You know, Ridley Scott really drags the tension out here, really drags it out until she blows the lock. And then the alien is sucked out of the piping, and we see it holding itself in the doorway. But she's grabbed some harpoon gun, shoots it, and it actually does, the force of the harpoon gun does blow it out, and she hits the door close button, but it closes on the cable, and the gun is still in the shuttle, but the cable is still out, so the alien is still there. And we see from an external shot that it's going to try to crawl up one of the thruster nozzles and maybe somehow find a way to get into the ship from there. But Ridley makes her way to the thrusters, hits the button, and finally blows the bloody thing out. Really great. I mean, it takes everything she has and every trick she has up her book to kill this bloody thing. Finally, it's dead, and we get this nice moment of, you know, it's over. She's bedding down to sleep, and we are out. And that is the end of Alien. Yeah, so my summary of this movie is two main things here. Several main things, I should say. First of all, Ridley really understands how horror films work, and that's a huge thing. And it's a big difference between Ridley and Cameron. As you'll see, for all the creepiness of the aliens, in the sequel, you're not really scared as much. It's tension. There's dramatic action tension there, but there's not a lot of horror. And Ridley really, really understands horror, and he really understands how it works and the type of setup that it needs and the space and silence that it needs. The film was also amazingly cast. I mean, there isn't a weak link in this cast. You know, having Ripley's character go from kind of a stick-in-the-mud warrant officer to this incredible woman, you know, who just flowers under pressure is wonderful. The designs of the creature, the way Ridley shoots widescreen, you know, and so he can do tension and action on the close confines of the ship, and he can do like incredible alien vistas on the world and ships, and it's a virtuoso performance. And to me, the ace in the hole here is the setup of the movie, how realistic everything looks, and especially how all of these people talk as they're on the ship, the no-nonsense dialogue that makes you think that you're watching sort of NASA C-SPAN, as it were. The quasi-tech talk, the way the dialogue is so off-center and off-kilter, almost, you know, naturalistic as a documentary, sets the scene that you're not so much in a movie as in an experience. You know, that this, I don't know, the realism factor here is so high. To me, there's the Alien sequels, which are varying quality, and there's Alien. And this movie stands head and shoulders above the rest of the pack. Even Cameron's Aliens, which I think is a terrific film and one of the better sci-fi movies ever done. But I still think Alien as a film stands head and shoulders above it in terms of, you know, the depth of it, the care of it, the realism of it, how amazing it is. You know, I'll be covering the entire franchise. Obviously, what's followed from this film, Cameron's sequel, Aliens, and then we had David Fincher's Alien 3, and then I believe Jean-Claude Junot, I'm not sure if I'm getting his whole name right, Alien Resurrection, Paul Thomas Anderson, Alien vs. Predator, and then Alien vs. Predator 2, Requiem. And those latter two films I will not be covering because they're ridiculous. And then Prometheus, which I thought was a unfortunate entry that's trying to explain everything behind it, but the screenwriters in Ridley are just not up to the task. I don't know, it was a disappointment. So, and there's obviously Prometheus 2 is in development. And now here in 2015, Neil Blomkamp, if anyone hasn't heard this information, the guy who directed District 9, Elysium, and Chappie, is now setting up an Alien sequel. And what he's going to do is he's going to scrap Alien 3, Alien Resurrection, and the, you know, Alien versus Predator stuff, and he's going to set a direct sequel to Cameron's Aliens and bring back Michael Biehn and Sigourney Weaver, which definitely a very interesting notion here. I do like Blomkamp, although I think he's not very strong writing-wise, so I have no idea what that might be like. Anyway, there have been lots of spin-off material besides the films. There's been a ton of comics, lots of Alien vs. Predator comics, but Alien comics. I think there was even a Superman vs. Alien comic. There's been lots of novelizations of the movies, a couple of novels that were taken, just written as original novels. There's been some video games as well. I think Aliens Colonial Marines came out this year. None of them have gotten much in the way of good ratings. And that's it. So, I'll be covering the Alien franchise up to Resurrection in this podcast. All I have really to say about Ridley's Alien. And I want to thank you very much for listening. You can find Sci-Fi On Screen at scifionscreen.com. You can find us on Facebook, You can search for us in a smartphone podcast app and subscribe, and you can get episodes as they upload, as I upload them. I want to thank everyone for listening, as always, and I will see you next time.